Before we get started, this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. They've got a full Series 82 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams weighted just like the real thing. Check it out at certfuel.com.
Highly recommend them. Yeah.
Totally. So let's just jump right in. Imagine the scenario, okay? You've got a $50 million whale on the line.
Oh, nice. The dream scenario.
Right. The ink on the contracts is practically drying. The champagne is poured. The bonuses are already mentally spent.
I can picture it.
And then, out of nowhere, the SEC steps in, completely unwinds the entire deal, and just fines your firm into oblivion.
A literal nightmare.
And why? Because you didn't realize that a simple power of attorney is completely legally worthless for a corporate account.
Ouch. Yeah, that happens more often than you'd think, honestly.
It's crazy. Today, we are mastering the absolute minefield of customer documentation and screening for your Series 82 exam.
Because we have this, romanticized view of high finance, like
Yeah.
billionaires on yachts, handshakes that move markets.
Movie stuff, basically.
Right, exactly. But the reality of a private placement is that it is a massive bureaucratic obstacle course.
So much paperwork.
Tons of it. The momentum of a massive deal can hit a brick wall if a representative cannot produce the right document in the exact right format before a highly specific deadline.
And that is exactly our mission today. We are basically looking at the anatomy of a deal's paperwork. But listen, we aren't just going to read you a list of rules like some dry textbook.
No, please no. That's the worst way to learn.
Exactly. If you try to memorize this stuff in a vacuum, you will fail the exam. I mean, my brain would just shut off. So our focus today is on the why.
The why is everything.
Right, because once you understand the paranoid, hyper-cautious logic of the SEC and Fang or I, you don't even have to memorize the
You
rules.
can just deduce them.
Exactly. It's the ultimate cheat code for exam day.
What's fascinating here is that the regulators don't make these rules just to torture financial professionals, even if it feels like it.
It definitely feels like it sometimes.
Oh, sure. But every single document requirement, every retention timeline, every signature is a reaction to a past disaster.
Like someone messed up really badly in the past, right?
Exactly. A massive fraud, a money laundering scheme, a completely blown deal. When you learn the history and the mechanism behind the rule, it actually sticks in your brain.
And to keep us grounded today, and honestly, because standard lectures put me straight to sleep, we are going to play out these rules using a recurring cast of characters.
I love this idea.
Yeah, it helps me visualize it. So we have three main players today. First up, we have Riley the rep. Riley is a well-meaning but sometimes forgetful broker.
We all know O'Reilly.
Right, he's always chasing the commission, maybe running a little too fast for his compliance department.
He's the guy who thinks a verbal yes, sure, is a legally binding contract.
100%. Then we have Ingrid the investor. Now, Ingrid is very wealthy. In some of our scenarios, she's a qualified institutional buyer. She's a bit eccentric, but she has the capital.
She's the $50 million whale.
Exactly. And finally, we have Sam the sponsor. Sam is the highly stressed issuer, maybe a startup founder or a fund manager who is just desperately sweating through his suit, trying to get his deal funded before he runs out of
A
cash.
perfect cast for a very stressful play. So where do we begin?
We begin before any money moves, before an account is even a twinkle in Riley's eye. Riley the rep wants to talk to Ingrid the investor about Sam the sponsor's new deal.
Makes sense. He knows she has money.
Right. But how do they initiate that conversation legally? Because Riley can't just take out a billboard, right?
Literally not.
He can't just tweet the deal terms out to the universe.
No, the SEC would come down on him instantly. The very first step before a representative shares any non-public details about an offering is establishing that the contact is a legitimate potential investor.
A legitimate prospect.
Exactly. The firm must confirm this before sharing the deal details.
I always think about this like a family recipe. You don't hand over the secret recipe to your grandmother's famous award-winning chili before checking if the person even likes chili.
That's a great way to put it.
Or worse, you need to check if they secretly work for a rival chili company. You have to establish they are a legitimate prospect first.
Right, and the reason why this rule exists goes to the very heart of a private placement. The key word is private.
Right. It's not for everybody.
Exactly. These deals are exempt from standard SEC public registration because they are not being offered to the general public.
So if Riley just starts blasting out Sam's highly sensitive financial projections to random people,
Then he risks blowing up the regulatory exemption. And if you lose that exemption, the SEC will say you are conducting an illegal, unregistered public offering.
and that's when the massive fines start flying. So, step one. Identify that Ingrid is a legitimate prospect. Once Riley does that, what is the very first piece of actual paperwork?
The confidentiality agreement? The NDA?
The non-disclosure agreement? The document literally everyone signs and nobody actually reads.
Basically, yeah.
So Ingrid is identified as a prospect, and now Riley slides an NDA across the table. Why does this exist in a financial context?
Well, its sole purpose is to protect the issuer's sensitive commercial information.
Like what kind of information?
We're talking about Sam the sponsor's audited financial statements.
Yeah.
His 3-year business plans, proprietary deal terms, maybe his intellectual property.
Stuff you do not want public.
Exactly. Mm. Sam is desperate for cash, but he is terrified that Ingrid will look at his business model, say no thanks, and then hand that model straight to his biggest competitor.
Or just steal the idea and do it herself, since she obviously has the capital.
Right.
So timing-wise, Riley is putting this NDA in front of Ingrid before he gives her the private placement memorandum, the PPM, right? Before any of the heavy due diligence material.
Precisely. You cannot put the toothpaste back in the tube. You don't ask for the NDA after they've already seen the secret sauce.
No, I know there is a massive exam trap right here, like a trap door that a lot of candidates just fall straight through.
Yes. This is where the exam tries to get you. Hmm. They will give you this beautifully written scenario where Ingrid signs the NDA, she asks some brilliant questions, and then Riley immediately executes a trade for her.
Because he assumes she's a fully vetted customer now.
Exactly. He thinks, oh, she signed the firm's paperwork, we're good to go.
And that's illegal.
It is a massive compliance failure. Signing a confidentiality agreement does not make a prospective investor a customer.
Wow. Okay.
It does not open an account. It is purely an information shield. It has absolutely zero power to facilitate a financial transaction.
So it's literally just a gag order, basically.
Yes. Just a promise to keep a secret.
Okay. So Riley can't take her money yet. But let's dig into the why of the NDA a bit more, because there is a very specific legal nuance here regarding something called Regulation FD.
Ah, yes. Fair disclosure.
Fair disclosure, right. I find this incredibly confusing. What happens if Sam, the sponsor, is running a public company, but he's doing a private deal to raise some quick cash?
This is a brilliant nuance to explore because it shows how different SEC rules basically crash into each other. Regulation FD was created to prevent selective disclosure by public companies.
What does that mean in plain English?
It says that if a reporting issuer, meaning a publicly traded company, discloses material non-public information to a Wall Street insider or a big investor, they must simultaneously disclose it to the whole public.
Okay, right. So they can't just whisper to their favorite hedge fund buddies that earnings are going to be terrible.
Exactly.
Because then the hedge fund can short the stock before the retail investors even find out. That's the whole point of Reg FD. Level the playing field.
You nailed it. The SEC hates an uneven playing field.
Yeah.
But if a public company wants to do a private capital raise, which they are legally allowed to do, how can they show their private books to a big investor without immediately publishing a press release to the whole world?
Because if they publish it, it ruins the private nature of the deal.
Exactly. So there is a carve-out in Regulation FD. The duty to publicly disclose does not apply if the disclosure is made to a person who expressly agrees to maintain the disclosed information in confidence.
Ah, oh, I see. So the signed NDA is the magic key.
Yes. The NDA places Ingrid safely inside that regulatory exclusion.
So Sam, the sponsor, can share the juicy, material, non-public deal information with her without triggering Regulation FD's public disclosure duty.
Right, because the SEC's logic here is that if Ingrid is legally bound to secrecy, she can't trade on it in the public markets, and she can't leak it, so the public isn't being disadvantaged.
That makes total sense. But here's my question. What if Sam, the sponsor, isn't a public company at all?
Okay.
What if he's just two guys in a garage in Silicon Valley, a pure non-reporting startup? Does Regulation FD apply to his NDA?
And this is exactly the kind of nuance you need to spot on the exam. A typical private placement issuer, like a startup, reports to nobody. They aren't public.
Right.
They don't file 10Ks or 10Qs. Therefore, Regulation FD never applied to them in the first place.
So, listener, I am asking you directly right now. Stop what you're doing and think about this. If Sam is a non-reporting startup, does his NDA have anything to do with Regulation FD?
Nope.
Not at all.
It doesn't apply at all. For a startup, the NDA is just protecting his commercial chili recipe. The Reg FD analysis is only alive if Sam is a reporting issuer.
Like if he's doing a PIPE, a private investment in public equity.
A PIPE, right.
If the exam question says Sam is conducting a PIPE transaction, your alarm bell should ring. That means he's public, and Regulation FD is highly relevant.
So the NDA is doing double duty, then.
Exactly. Protecting commercial secrets and satisfying the Reg FD exclusion. You really have to read the identity of the issuer carefully before you answer.
Okay, so Ingrid has signed the NDA. She likes the deal. Sam's financials look solid. His business plan is brilliant. Now she wants to actually give Riley some money and open a brokerage account.
Here comes the paperwork.
This brings us to the alphabet soup of customer screening. We have CIP, which stands for Customer Identification Program, and we have KYC, which stands for Know Your Customer.
Yes. Two distinct regulatory frameworks that candidates constantly mix up.
I really need you to directly compare these two for me, because if I'm Riley and I'm asking Ingrid for her driver's license, I don't care what acronym it is, I'm just getting her ID.
Right. In practice, it feels like the same thing.
But for the exam, they are completely different beasts.
Right. They are very different. Let's use an analogy. Think of the Customer Identification Program, or CIP, as the bouncer at the door of an exclusive nightclub.
Okay, the bouncer.
Its job happens right at the threshold, right around the time the account opens. CIP was basically born out of the Patriot Act after 9/11. It is fundamentally an anti-money laundering and anti-terrorism tool.
So its whole purpose is to keep bad actors out.
Its sole purpose is to verify that Ingrid is a real human being or a real legal entity, and that she is exactly who she claims to be.
The bouncer. He shines a flashlight on your ID, looks at your face, makes sure you aren't on a banned list, and lets you in the door.
Precisely. And once you are inside the club, the bouncer's primary job is done. Know Your Customer, or KYC, on the other hand, is the ongoing relationship. It's the bartender, the VIP host, the club manager who continuously interacts with you all night.
KYC is the bartender. I love that so much.
KYC requires the firm to use reasonable diligence to know the essential facts about every customer on an ongoing basis. It's not about terrorism, really.
What's it about, then?
It's about suitability and service. You need to know these essential facts, her risk tolerance, her liquidity needs, her employment status, to effectively service the account, follow special instructions, and comply with securities laws.
So CIP is a one-time event around account opening, and KYC is a continuous loop that never stops as long as the account is open.
Exactly.
Okay, let's look closer at the bouncer first, the CIP. What exactly does Riley the rep need to collect from Ingrid before he can open this account?
The rule mandates four specific requirements that must be obtained before opening the account. Name, date of birth for an individual, address, and an identification number.
Okay, name, DOB, address, ID number. Let's break those down because I know the SEC loves to get nitpicky.
Oh, they do.
Let's talk about address. Can Ingrid just give Riley a P.O. box? She's eccentric, right? Maybe she doesn't want people knowing where her huge mansion is.
No. A standard P.O. box alone does not work.
Why not?
The Patriot Act wants to know exactly where the authorities can physically find you if you start funding illicit activities. A P.O. box doesn't give them a door to knock on. It must be a residential or business street address.
Okay, but what if she genuinely doesn't have a street address? Like, she literally lives on a massive yacht that sails around international waters.
Well, if a customer genuinely lacks a residential or business street address, the rule allows for an Army post office or fleet post office box number.
Like an APO or FPO?
Right. Or they can use the street address of a next of kin or another contact individual.
Oh, interesting.
And for an entity like a trust or a corporation, it's a principal place of business or local office. But a standalone P.O. box at the local post office is a hard no.
Okay, that makes sense. What about the identification number?
If Ingrid is a U.S. person, that number is her taxpayer identification number.
Usually a social security number, right?
Yes, for an individual. Or an employer identification number for an entity.
And what if she's not a U.S. person?
If she is a non-U.S. person, it could be a passport number and country issuance, an alien identification card number, or any other government-issued document showing nationality or residence that bears a photograph.
Now, here's a hypothetical scenario for you. Let's say Ingrid just moved to the U.S., or maybe she just formed a brand new LLC to make this specific investment. She applied for her taxpayer ID, her TIN. The IRS is processing it.
Okay, I see where you're going.
She has the receipt from the IRS, but she doesn't actually have the 9-digit number yet. Can Riley open the account? Because Sam's deal is closing on Friday at 5 p.m. and she desperately needs to wire the funds.
This is a highly testable scenario. Yeah. And the answer is yes, Riley can open the account.
Really? Even without the number?
Yes. This is the one major exception to the collect before opening rule. The account can open without the TIN if the firm confirms that the application for the TIN was filed prior to the account opening.
Oh, okay.
And the firm must obtain the actual number within a reasonable period of time after the account opens.
Okay, so that covers collection. Name, DOB, address, ID number. All collected before opening, mostly. But collecting a number isn't the same thing as proving it's real, right?
Not at all.
So what about the actual verification? When does Riley have to prove she isn't making this all up?
The timeline here is fascinating, actually. Identifying information must be collected prior to opening. But the rule states that verification happens within a reasonable time before or after the account opens.
Wait, after?
Yes, after.
So the bouncer lets you in the door, you're at the bar ordering a drink, and the bouncer taps you on the shoulder 5 minutes later to double-check your ID under a better light.
That's a perfect way to look at it. Collection is a hard stop at the door. Verification is a process that can bleed into the beginning of the relationship.
Why on earth does the SEC allow that? Why not just demand everything is perfectly verified before you open it?
Because of the sheer speed of modern commerce. If every brokerage firm had to wait 3 days to manually verify public records before issuing an account number, the financial system would grind to an absolute halt.
That's true. People expect instant gratification now.
Right. It allows the administrative shell of the account to be created so the client can start moving money into it while the back office compliance team finishes the background checks.
Okay, that makes sense. So how does the firm actually verify her?
They can use documentary methods or non-documentary methods.
Yeah.
Documentary is exactly what it sounds like. For Ingrid, it's looking at an unexpired government-issued driver's license or passport.
Simple enough.
If she is opening the account for a trust, it's looking at the trust instrument itself.
And non-documentary? Is Riley just, like, stalking her Instagram to see if she looks rich?
Not quite. Non-documentary methods involve contacting the customer independently, checking public databases, pulling consumer reporting agency files, or checking references with other financial institutions.
What if Ingrid is opening an account for a deeply obscure offshore entity? Like, let's call it Ingrid Holdings Cayman Island LLC.
Okay.
Riley can't verify it with documents because the Cayman registry is private, and he can't verify it with public databases for the exact same reason. What's the fallback there?
If the firm's risk assessment requires it, and both documentary and non-documentary methods fail to verify the entity, the fallback rule kicks in. The firm must obtain information about the individuals with authority or control over the account.
So you look straight through the opaque corporate shell and you identify the actual human beings pulling the strings.
Exactly. In this case, you verify Ingrid herself.
Okay, but what if even that fails? What if Riley just cannot figure out who Ingrid actually is, or he suspects her documents are completely forged?
You can't just shrug and leave the account open in a state of limbo forever. The CIP rules mandate that firms must have written procedures describing exactly what to do when they cannot form a reasonable belief that they know the true identity of a customer.
What do those procedures have to say?
Well, they must describe when the firm should flat out decline opening the account in the first place.
Right.
They must describe the terms under which a customer may conduct transactions while verification is still ongoing. They must outline when to close an account after attempts to verify fail. And, crucially, they must describe when the firm should file a suspicious activity report, or SAR.
Hold up. Hold on.
What's on?
I am breaking the fourth wall here for a second to reset your attention, listener.
Huh.
If you are washing dishes, if you are driving, I need you to shake out your arms, take a deep breath, and focus. We are about to talk about records retention.
I know. Everyone hates records retention.
It sounds so incredibly dry, but I promise you it is highly, highly testable. The exam writers know you hate it, so they test it constantly to punish you. Lock this next part into your brain right now.
It's true. If you're going to miss a question on CIP, it will probably be because of the five-year split.
The five-year split. Okay, what is it and why does it exist?
A firm obviously has to keep records of all this CIP data. But there are two completely different starting clocks for the five-year retention period, depending on what type of record it is.
Okay, I'm listening.
The record of a customer's identifying information, the name, the date of birth, the address, the ID number, that data must be kept for 5 years after the account is closed.
Okay, 5 years after Ingrid takes her money, closes the account, and walks away. That seems straightforward.
Right, but the verification records, meaning a description of the documents you relied on, like the driver's license, the non-documentary methods you used, and how you resolved any discrepancies, those records are kept for 5 years after the record is made.
Wait, 5 years after the record is made? That is so sneaky.
It is a massive trap. This is where the exam tries to get you.
Let me make sure I have this straight. Let's say Ingrid opens her account in 2010. Riley takes a photocopy of her driver's license. She keeps the account open for 20 years until 2030, and then she finally closes it.
Okay, tracking.
Her identifying information, her name, DOB, address, must be kept for 25 years total, right? 20 years while it's open, plus 5 years after it closes, meaning the firm keeps it until 2035.
Correct.
But the photocopy of her driver's license that Riley took on day one, the firm was only required to keep that for 5 years after the record was made, meaning that retention requirement actually expired back in 2015.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And the exam will test this by anchoring every single CIP record to account closure in the multiple choice options. You have to track the split. Identifying info is anchored to account closure. Verification info is anchored to when the record is made.
But why? Why would the SEC split the timelines like that? It seems designed just to create compliance errors and fines.
It does seem like that, but think about the logic. A photocopy of a driver's license from 20 years ago is completely useless to law enforcement today. The ID is expired, the person looks completely different, the security features on the card have completely changed.
That's true.
Storing millions of outdated physical ID copies is just a massive data breach waiting to happen. But the foundational data, the fact that John Doe, with this specific social security number held in account here, that identity record is forever relevant to the historical transaction history of the account.
Wow. Okay. That actually makes complete sense when you explain it like that. I will never forget that split note. So we have collection, we have verification, and we have record keeping. That is three parts of the CIP.
Right.
But earlier you said there were five parts to a CIP program. What are the forgotten two?
The fourth part is a mandatory comparison against government lists.
Like watch lists.
Exactly. The firm must determine whether the customer appears on any known or suspected terrorist lists issued by the federal government. And this check must happen within a reasonable period of time after the account opens, or earlier.
Makes sense. Keep the known bad guys out of the club.
And the fifth part is customer notice. You can't just secretly run these intense background checks on people. The firm must provide the customer with adequate notice that they are requesting information to verify their identity.
Does Riley have to read her a Miranda warning or something?
No, it's much simpler. And this notice must reach the customer before the account is opened. It is usually accomplished by a posting in the firm's lobby, a prominent notice on their website, or just standard wording right there on the account application itself.
Okay, one more thing on screening before we move on. Let's look at the KYC side, the bartender. Let's say Riley the rep is doing his ongoing KYC diligence, and he suddenly notices that Ingrid is transferring money into her account from 50 different obscure offshore shell companies in the span of like an hour.
Right.
And then she is immediately wiring that money out to a casino in Macau.
That is a classic money laundering pattern.
Yeah.
Layering and integration.
Exactly. So, listener, I'm asking you directly. If you are Riley and you see this happening, should you pick up the phone, call Ingrid, investigate this yourself, and try to clear it up?
Think about it.
Absolutely not. Do not play detective.
Right. A registered representative does not play Batman. If information gathered through KYC or CIP suggests suspicious activity, the rule is incredibly strict. You escalate it to a designated principal or the firm's anti-money laundering compliance officer.
Pass it up the chain.
Do not try to resolve it independently. And more importantly, do not tip off the client that you suspect them of anything. Just escalate.
Escalate. Okay, so Riley has verified Ingrid is exactly who she claims to be. The bouncer let her in. The bartender knows her order. But proving her identity doesn't automatically mean she's legally allowed to press the buy button, does it?
Not necessarily.
Like if her money is tied up in a trust, for instance. This brings us to account authorizations.
Exactly. The account is open, but who actually has the legal authority to transact business in it? The paperwork must perfectly match the legal entity of the account.
The rule's core demand is pretty simple, right?
The core demand of the customer account information rule is that for an entity account, the firm must record the names of any persons authorized to transact business on behalf of that entity.
Just the names. That seems too easy.
Well, the rule itself just says you must obtain the names. It does not actually mandate or define any particular document title in the rule text itself. However, the exam tests the strict industry practice paperwork that firms use to legally obtain and verify those names.
So there's a disconnect between the bare rule and what we actually do.
Right. There are three specific documents you must memorize, and you must perfectly match them to the entity type.
I call this the matching game. It's like claiming a package at the post office. If a package is addressed to Ingrid's corporation, you can't show up with Ingrid's personal birth certificate to claim it.
The postmaster doesn't care that Ingrid owns the company.
Exactly. You need corporate documentation because the corporation is a completely separate legal fiction. So let's play the game. If the account is an individual account, just a regular retail brokerage account in Ingrid's name, but she wants someone else, like her nephew, to trade for her while she's on vacation, what's the document?
Power of attorney, or POA. This document names the agent, in this case, the nephew, who the individual customer appoints to act on the account.
Okay, individual matches to power of attorney. Next up, what if the account is a trust?
Trust documents, specifically the trust instrument. This establishes the legal framework of the trust and explicitly names the trustee who is the person authorized to trade.
Oh, and here's a bonus point for synthesizing the material. As we discuss in the CIP section, a trust instrument also doubles as a verification document proving the entity actually exists, right?
Yes. Two birds, one stone.
Yeah.
It verifies the entity for the bouncer and it authorizes the trader for the bartender.
Love it. Okay, third one. What if the account is a corporation?
Corporate resolution. A corporation is a legal fiction, right? It has no pulse, it has no hands to sign a check. It acts through its board of directors.
Makes sense.
So, the corporate resolution is the official document where the board of directors authorizes specific corporate officers to open and transact in a brokerage account on a company's behalf.
So, to recap quickly, individual gets a POA, trust gets a trust instrument, corporation gets a corporate resolution.
If you're going to get tricked on this section, this is exactly how they'll do it. They will give you a fact pattern that swaps the officer authorizing document with the agent authorizing document.
Give me an example.
They will write a scenario saying, Ingrid wants to authorize her CFO to trade on her corporate account. So she submits a notarized power of attorney to Riley.
And Riley says, great, thanks.
And Riley just committed a massive violation. It sounds highly plausible to a layperson because everyone knows what a POA is, but it is wrong. Corporations do not use POAs to authorize trading. They use corporate resolutions.
Matching the wrong document to the wrong entity type is a classic exam gotcha. Keep your packages sorted.
That's all.
So Riley rejects the POA, gets the corporate resolution, and we are good to go. The account is officially authorized. Let's talk about the trading itself. Here is the scenario. Ingrid loves Riley. She thinks he's a financial genius.
Good for Riley.
She tells Riley, look, I trust you completely. Just buy whatever Sam the sponsor is selling whenever you think the time is right for whatever amount you think is a good deal.
Wow.
Riley is absolutely thrilled. He's ready to start firing off massive trades. But expert, you need to step in here and ruin his day. What kind of discretion is this and what paperwork does he actually need?
That is full discretionary authorization. It means the registered representative Riley is making the three major decisions. He decides which security to buy or sell, how much to buy or sell, and whether to execute the transaction at all.
So he has total control.
Yes. And Riley cannot just start trading based on a verbal, I trust you. Full discretion shifts a massive amount of liability onto the firm. So it requires three heavy pieces of written documentation.
What are the three requirements?
First, the customer's prior written authorization. Ingrid has to physically sign a document granting this trading power to a stated individual, which is Riley.
Okay, signature one.
Second, the firm must accept the account in writing. This can be evidenced by the firm itself or by a designated partner, officer, or manager.
Okay, so Ingrid says yes in writing. The firm says yes in writing. What's the third?
Third, and this is the heavy operational lift, a principal of the firm must approve each discretionary order promptly in writing. Furthermore, the firm must review all discretionary accounts at frequent intervals to prevent excessive trading, which is known as churning.
Okay, I want to use an analogy here. It's like Ingrid is handing Riley the keys to her sports car and saying, drive us anywhere in the country for vacation. You pick the route, you pick the hotel.
Right.
Because Riley has total, absolute control over the destination and the gas pedal, the firm needs tons of paperwork up front, written acceptance, and a principal is basically checking the GPS history after every single turn to make sure Riley isn't just driving in circles to rack up mileage fees, which is basically what churning is.
That is exactly the regulatory concern. Missing any one of those three written requirements, customer authorization, firm acceptance, principal approval of each order, makes the trade totally unauthorized.
Okay, so that's full discretion. What if Ingrid doesn't want to hand over the keys completely? What if she says to Riley, look, I definitely want to buy exactly 10,000 shares of Sam's new fund. I am deciding that. You just pick the exact time today and the exact price today to get me the best execution.
That is limited time and price discretion. Ingrid has already decided the what Sam's fund and the how much 10,000 shares. She is only giving Riley discretion over the execution variables, which are time and price.
So does Riley still need the massive stack of written approvals, the customer signature, the firm acceptance, the principal approving the trade?
No. Because the representative is not choosing the security or the amount, this narrower discretion falls completely outside the heavy written authorization rules we just discussed. The only strict requirement is that any exercise of this time and price discretion must be clearly reflected on the order ticket.
Okay, that sounds so much easier. Riley loves that. But there's a catch, right? With the SEC, there's always a catch.
Yes, the Cinderella rule.
The Cinderella rule.
Limited time and price discretion granted by a retail customer turns into a pumpkin at the end of the business day it was granted. Unless Ingrid signs and dates a written extension, the discretion completely expires when the closing bell rings.
Wait, I need to push back on this. That seems ridiculously inefficient. Let's say Ingrid tells Riley to buy at $50. The market closes at $51. Riley doesn't buy.
Right, because the price wasn't right.
The very next morning at 9:31 a.m., the market opens and hits $50. Why on earth should Riley be paralyzed just because the clock struck midnight? He knows exactly what she wants.
It seems inefficient until you look at market risk. A tremendous amount can happen overnight. Earnings reports are released, CEOs resign, wars break out overseas.
Okay, that's fair.
The SEC's logic is that Ingrid made her decision based on the information available yesterday. The firm should not assume she still wants to buy that stock today in a completely changed environment without reconfirming with her. It protects the client from yesterday's assumptions.
Okay. When you put it like that, it makes sense. It protects her from a massive gap down at the open. Are there any exceptions to that Cinderella rule?
Yes. For institutional accounts, the end-of-day expiration does not apply to an institutional account acting under valid good-till-canceled instructions on not-held basis. Institutions are sophisticated enough to manage their own overnight risk. But for a standard retail customer like Ingrid, it expires at the end of the day.
Now here is where things get genuinely muddy and we need to clear the water. Expert, explain the two faces of full and limited.
This is a linguistic trap that candidates fall into constantly, because the industry reuses the exact same words to mean completely different things. When we talk about a representative's discretion, like Riley deciding what to trade, full means choosing the asset and amount. Limited means choosing only time and price.
Right, that's what we just went over.
But the exact same phrases, full and limited, are also used to describe the scope of a third-party power of attorney.
So earlier when we said Ingrid gives her nephew a power of attorney over her account.
Right. In that context, industry convention dictates that a limited trading authorization lets the nephew buy and sell securities, but he cannot withdraw cash or securities from the account.
Oh, I see.
A full trading authorization lets the nephew trade and gives him the power to withdraw cash or securities, basically letting him write checks to himself out of her account.
Oh, wow. Okay, so if I am taking the exam and I see the word limited on a question, I have to literally stop and ask myself, who are we talking about? Is this a broker trading for a client? If yes, limited means time and price. But if it's a third-party agent, like a nephew or a spouse, limited means they can trade, but they can't take the money and run to Vegas.
Exactly. You must read the question carefully to establish the context before you answer. Don't just react to the buzzword.
Keep your head on a swivel.
Okay, let's pivot to the documents themselves. Let's say Sam, the sponsor, has drafted a 500-page private placement memorandum for his deal. It weighs as much as a small dog.
That's a lot of paper.
It costs $20 just to mail the thing. He wants to save trees and save postage by sending it to Ingrid electronically. Can you just email her a link?
Not without satisfying the SEC's 3-part test for electronic delivery. And what's fascinating here is that this entire framework comes from an SEC interpretive release from the year 2000.
Wait, the year 2000? Like Y2K, the era of dial-up internet and AOL CDs, we are still using rules from then.
Yes, it's decades old, but it remains the operative framework because it established timeless principles. The three elements are notice, access, and evidence of delivery. Let's break them down. Notice. Can Sam just put a huge banner on his website that says, hey everyone, the new PPM is available?
No. Notice must be direct and targeted. A website posting or a newspaper ad does not cut it by itself because the investor might never see it. Notice must reach the investor directly, like an email sent specifically to their inbox saying, the document you requested is now available at this link.
Okay, direct notice. Step two, access.
Access means the electronic media must be comparable to paper delivery. Sending a document in the standard PDF format is fine if that format is not so burdensome that it effectively prevents access.
Like what?
For example, back in 2000, not everyone had a PDF reader. So the rule says the firm should tell investors what software is needed to open it, and they must offer technical assistance at no cost if the investor can't open it.
So you can't send it in some highly obscure proprietary file format that requires a supercomputer to decode. It has to be accessible.
Right.
All right. Step three is the hardest one, evidence of delivery. How do you prove an email actually arrived and was read?
The primary, most foolproof way a firm satisfies this element is by obtaining the investor's informed consent to electronic delivery upfront.
Informed consent. What makes it informed? Because I agree on terms of service every day without being informed of anything.
To be legally informed under this rule, the investor must be told the specific electronic medium that will be used, like a specific website or a secure portal. They must be told about any potential costs they might incur, like online connection charges or printing costs.
Printing costs, right.
And they must be told the scope of the consent, including whether it's an indefinite agreement or if it only covers specific document types.
Okay, let's talk exam traps. What if Riley emails Ingrid and says, "Hi, Ingrid, I'm going to send you all the deal docs electronically from now on to save paper. If you object, please reply to this email." Ingrid says nothing. Can Riley start blasting her with PDFs?
No. Silence is not consent. Implied consent completely fails the test. Consent must be affirmative. The investor has to actively say yes. Furthermore, the investor retains the right to revoke that consent at any time and demand paper copies.
Always. Like, she can just change her mind whenever.
There's a slight caveat. If the initial agreement explicitly disclosed it, a firm might require revocation on an all-or-none basis, meaning Ingrid can't say, "I want the 500-page PPM electronically, but I want the 2-page subscription agreement mailed to me on paper." She either gets all of it electronically or all of it on paper.
Good to know. What about hyperlinks? If Sam sends an email with a link to the PPM and a separate link to the subscription agreement right below it, are those legally delivered together?
Yes. Documents that are hyperlinked to each other or listed together on the same website menu are treated as delivered together. The SEC views it as if they were placed in the same physical paper envelope.
The envelope theory. I love that. It makes visualizing the rule so much easier. Okay, what about a global consent? Can an investor say, "Look, Riley, I do 10 deals a year with you. Just send me everything for every issuer electronically forever."
Yes, an investor can give a global consent covering multiple issuers held through an intermediary as long as it meets all the informed consent requirements. It doesn't even need to name the specific issuers it covers.
But here is a major scenario for you, listener. Think about this carefully. Can Riley tell Ingrid, "Listen, in order to open this standard retail brokerage account with me, you must sign this global consent for electronic delivery. If you don't sign it and agree to PDFs, I refuse to open the account." Can you do that?
Well,
nope. That is illegal.
This is known as the global consent trap. If a firm conditions the opening of a standard brokerage account on the investor giving global consent, the SEC says that consent is no longer considered informed. It is considered coerced.
Coerced, wow.
And absent other evidence of delivery, the delivery element fails entirely.
Are there any exceptions to that? What if it's like Robinhood or E-Trade?
The only narrow exception is if the firm is strictly an online broker. If the firm's entire business model requires accounts to be open and all transactions to be conducted strictly online, then they can mandate electronic delivery. Because the whole relationship is fundamentally digital, paper was never an option.
Right.
But for a standard full-service broker like Riley, you cannot force global consent as a condition of doing business.
Brilliant. Okay, so Ingrid loves the electronic PPM. Mm-hmm. She's read it on her iPad. She's ready to pull the trigger. What documents actually facilitate the sale? We have three big ones left in the deal paperwork: the QIB certification letter, the investor questionnaire, and the subscription agreement.
Let's start with the QIB letter.
First off, what is a qualified institutional buyer, very briefly, and how do we prove Ingrid's company is one?
We won't reteach the specific mathematical thresholds defining a QIB today, but generally it's a massive institution managing at least $100 million in discretionary assets. To prove this elite status, the purchaser delivers a QIB certification letter to the broker.
Okay, seems simple.
But it has very strict rules. First, who signs it? It must be signed by the chief financial officer, the CFO, or another executive officer of the purchasing institution. If it's a family of investment companies, the investment advisor's executive officer signs it.
So you can't just have the summer intern sign it, or even a mid-level portfolio manager.
Exactly. Why? Because the CFO actually knows the audited, verifiable discretionary assets under management, not just the inflated marketing numbers a portfolio manager might use.
That makes total sense.
Second, the content of the letter. It must specify the exact dollar amount of securities the purchaser owns and invests on a discretionary basis.
Wait, so Ingrid's CFO can't just write a letter saying, "We hereby certify that we are a qualified institutional buyer, trust us," and just sign it?
A letter that merely asserts QIB status without providing the math is an instant fail. It must state the specific dollar amount, and it must state that amount as of a specific date on or since the close of the purchaser's most recent fiscal year.
Okay, so the CFO writes, "As of December 31st, we own and invest $150 million on a discretionary basis." Riley gets this letter. Does Riley have to go hire a forensic accountant to audit Ingrid's books to make sure her CFO isn't lying?
No. The firm can reasonably rely on the purchaser's signed certification letter. They do not have to independently verify every element of the purchaser's QID status, assuming the letter meets the technical requirements, and there are no glaring red flags that suggest it's a forgery.
Okay, document number two, the investor questionnaire.
The questionnaire is simply the fact-gathering tool. It collects the financial and background information the firm needs to screen the prospective investor, determine their net worth, their sophistication, and their eligibility for the offering under Regulation D.
Okay, but here's a gotcha. I see candidates mess up all the time. Is the questionnaire the same thing as the customer's investment profile?
No. Gathering the facts is the questionnaire. That is just the physical tool. Using those facts to build, evaluate, and approve the customer's investment profile happens afterward. It's a separate analytical step. Don't confuse the data collection tool with the analytical process.
Got it. Okay, document number three, the big one, the subscription agreement. This is the document where Ingrid says, "I commit to buying X amount of shares for X amount of dollars." She signs it. She attaches her massive wire transfer confirmation. She hands it to Riley. Listener, I am asking you directly. Riley has the signed sub-agreement and the money in his hand. Is the deal done? Is Ingrid officially an investor in Sam's company?
Think about it.
The answer is no.
Right. The transaction is not complete just because the investor signed the paperwork and funded the account. The issuer, Sam, the sponsor, or the fund manager must accept the subscription, commonly evidenced by a countersignature on the document.
Why? I need to push back again. If I walk into a gas station and hand a cashier a $20 bill for a candy bar, I bought it. The cashier doesn't have to countersign my receipt to finalize the sale. Why is a private placement different?
Because private funds are highly restricted legal vehicles. They often have strict limits on total investor counts, like the 99 investor limit for a 3C1 fund. They have strict ratios on accredited versus non-accredited investors.
Oh, right.
If Sam just lets anyone buy in automatically without his approval, he could accidentally exceed his investor limit and blow up his entire fund's legal structure.
That would be a disaster.
Sam must retain the power to reject the subscription in whole or in part. He has to control the cap table. Only his countersignature finalizes the sale.
Ah, that makes perfect sense. He has to guard the gate to protect the fund. Okay, we have arrived at the final and perhaps the most extensively testable section of our deep dive, keeping secrets, Regulation SP, which covers privacy notices, opt-outs, and data breaches.
This is a massive, massive topic.
So Riley has done all this work. He's collected CIP data, KYC data, questionnaires, QIB letters, tax IDs, bank account numbers. He is sitting on a mountain of Ingrid's highly sensitive, non-public personal information, or NPI. Regulation SP is the federal shield that protects it. Let's start with the very first step, the initial privacy notice. When exactly does Ingrid get this document?
The strict rule is that a firm must give a consumer who becomes a customer a clear and conspicuous privacy notice no later than when the customer relationship is established.
Meaning when the account is opened, not 3 weeks later in the mail after the first trade settles.
Exactly. It has to be concurrent with establishing the relationship. And this notice is not just a vague promise to be nice. It has to detail the specific categories of NPI collected, what exactly is disclosed, who it's disclosed to, policies for protecting the data of former customers, and crucially, a clear explanation of the consumer's right to opt out of having their data shared with non-affiliated third parties.
Are there any exceptions to that strict ad account opening timing? Like, what if the account wasn't Ingrid's idea? What if she didn't walk into Riley's office? What if a judge appointed a trustee to move her inherited assets to Riley's firm while she was out of the country?
Yes, the SEC recognizes reality. There are three specific exceptions where the initial notice can be delivered within a reasonable time after establishing the relationship. The first is exactly what you just described. The relationship wasn't at the customer's election, like a court-appointed trustee transfer.
What are the other two?
The second is if providing immediate notice would substantially delay a transaction that the customer eagerly agreed to, and the customer verbally consents to receiving the notice later. The third is if an outside, non-affiliated broker opens the account for the customer without the carrying firm's prior knowledge. In those edge cases, a slight delay is allowed.
Okay, what if Ingrid never opens an account? What if she's just a prospect, a non-customer who filled out a questionnaire, but Riley wants to sell her contact info to a marketing firm because she's rich?
Even if she is just a consumer, not a customer, before a firm discloses a non-customer's MPI to a non-affiliated third party, they still have to provide an initial notice. A short-form notice works here, basically saying, our comprehensive privacy policy is available upon request, and giving her a clear way to opt out before the data is sold.
All right, let's talk about the opt-out rules, because this is where the exam traps are absolutely hiding in plain sight. Let's say Riley sends Ingrid the privacy notice. It's a thick packet of legalese. She throws it straight in the trash and never responds. Can Riley share her data with marketing firms?
Yes.
Wait, seriously?
This is a crucial fundamental point. Regulation SP defaults to opt out, not opt in. Silence equals consent to share.
That's wild.
If the consumer never actively responds to stop it, the firm is legally allowed to disclose the information, absent another conflicting rule.
I have to say that is genuinely infuriating from a consumer protection standpoint. So you're telling me the default state of my private financial data is that it can be sold unless I figure out how to navigate their labyrinth of paperwork to stop it?
Yes. This was a massive lobbying victory for the banking industry when the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act was passed. They argued that requiring opt-in for every single data transfer would cripple the modern financial system. So the burden is entirely on the consumer.
Wow. Okay, so to legally share her NPI, Riley has to provide the initial notice, provide an opt-out notice, give her a reasonable opportunity to opt out, and then receive no response. What defines a reasonable opportunity?
Usually the industry standard for a reasonable opportunity is 30 days from the date the notice was mailed, or 30 days from when an online customer acknowledges receipt of the notice electronically.
What if it's an isolated transaction? Like Ingrid walks in off the street, doesn't open an account, but just wants to do a one-time massive wire transfer accommodation?
For an isolated transaction, there is no 30-day window. The firm gives the notice right then and there at the desk and asks consumer to decide as a necessary part of the transaction before the wire completes.
Okay, and the method of opting out. This has to be reasonable too, right? For example, if Riley tells Ingrid she can only opt out by writing a personal letter in calligraphy and mailing it to a P.O. box in Antarctica, that is obviously not reasonable.
Exactly. The rule explicitly states that requiring the consumer to write and mail a personal letter as the only option is not a reasonable means of opting out.
So what is reasonable?
Reasonable means include checkboxes on a reply form, a simple web-based process, or a toll-free telephone number.
And when can she revoke her opt-out or change her mind?
A consumer can exercise their right to opt out at any time. And if they do, the firm must comply as soon as reasonably practicable. Notice that is a different standard than the 30 days they originally gave her to decide.
Oh, good point.
If she opts out on day 400 of the relationship, the firm has to stop sharing her data ASAP. And that opt-out stays effective forever until she actively revokes it in writing, or electronically if she agrees to that.
What about joint accounts? This is a great edge case. If Ingrid and her husband have a joint account, does Riley need both of them to opt out?
No. The firm can send one notice to the household. They can let one person opt out for everyone on the account, or they can let them opt out separately. But here is the exam trap. A firm can never force every joint consumer to opt out before honoring one person's request.
Oh, I see.
If Ingrid opts out, the firm must honor it for her data and the joint data, even if her husband threw his copy in the trash.
That protects the proactive spouse. I like it. Okay, but are there exceptions to this whole opt-out dance? Are there times when Riley can just share Ingrid's MPI without giving her the chance to stop it?
Yes. There are major exceptions that let the firm skip the opt-out requirement. The first major one is service providers and joint marketing. A firm can share MPI with a third party to perform necessary services for the firm, but it requires a strict confidentiality contract.
What kind of contract?
The contract must bar the third party from using the information for anything other than the specified purpose. It's not just a polite promise to keep it secret. It's a hard, legally binding limit on how they can use it.
Okay, so if Riley's firm hires a massive third-party printing company to print and mail out monthly account statements, he can give them Ingrid's name, address, and account balance without her opting in, because they are a service provider acting on the firm's behalf.
Correct. The second major exception is for processing and servicing transactions the consumer explicitly requested. If she asks for a wire transfer, you obviously have to share her account info with the receiving bank to make it happen.
And then there's the famous other exceptions list.
Yes, and I want to explicitly warn the listener here. Mm-hmm. If you're taking notes, underline this. Do not treat the other exceptions category as a vague, anything that sounds reasonable carve out. It is a strictly closed list of exactly 7 specific things.
Let's hear the 7.
Number 1, with the consumer's explicit consent. Number 2, for fraud and liability protection. Number 3, disclosures to rating agencies or auditors. Number 4, to law enforcement, if permitted by law. Number 5, to consumer reporting agencies like credit bureaus. Number 6, in connection with the sale or merger of a business. And number 7, to comply with a subpoena or regulatory investigation.
So those 7 items are separate exceptions on a closed list. If an exam option isn't on that list and isn't a service provider or transaction processing, it's not an exception and an opt-out must be provided.
Exactly. Memorize the list of 7.
Okay, let's close this deep dive out with the absolute worst case scenario. Safeguarding and incident response. The hack. Let's say Riley leaves his firm-issued laptop at a coffee shop. It gets stolen, hacked, and Ingrid's MPI is completely compromised. What does Regulation SP require Riley's firm to do?
First, every firm must have a written incident response program in place before this ever happens. The program has to mandate that the firm assess the incident, contain and control it, and notify affected customers. They also have to actively oversee their service providers to make sure their security is up to par.
Let's talk about the regulatory clocks, because I know there are strict deadlines here, and the SEC loves to test numbers.
There are 2 critical clocks. The 72-hour clock belongs to the service provider. If a service provider's system is breached, say, that printing company we talked about earlier gets hacked, they must notify the broker-dealer within 72 hours of becoming aware of the breach.
So the printing company gets hacked. They have 3 days to tell Riley's firm. What is the firm's clock to tell Ingrid?
The firm's clock is 30 days. The firm must notify affected customers as soon as practicable, but no later than 30 days after becoming aware that unauthorized access occurred.
Hold on. 30 days from when the hack actually happened. Or 30 days from when they found out.
30 days from when they become aware. That is a massive legal distinction. If the laptop is stolen on May 1st, but the firm's IT department doesn't realize the encrypted data was actually accessed and decrypted until June 1st, the 30-day clock starts on June 1st, not May 1st.
Does the firm always have to notify the customers? What if it was just a laptop with encrypted data and they wiped it remotely before anyone could log in? Do they have to panic Ingrid for no reason?
No. There are exceptions to the notification duty. If the firm conducts a reasonable investigation and determines that substantial harm or inconvenience to the customer is unlikely, like your remote wipe example where the data was secured, the notification duty falls away.
Good.
Also, the U.S. Attorney General can order the firm to delay the notification for national security or law enforcement reasons.
Okay, here is a terrifying scenario. What if the hackers got into the firm's massive central database? The firm knows some data was taken, but the hackers covered their tracks, so the firm cannot pinpoint exactly whose accounts were compromised. Do they just keep quiet because they aren't sure?
Absolutely not. They have to use the shotgun approach. If the firm cannot tell exactly who was affected, they must notify everyone whose sensitive customer information resides in the breached system.
Everyone.
Yes. The only way you don't notify a specific person is if you can reasonably determine their specific information was definitively not accessed. And by the way, that notice must be clear, conspicuous, and in writing.
And finally, disposal. When you are done with the data, when the 5-year attention clock is finally up, you can't just throw the physical files in the dumpster behind the office, right?
Exactly. There is a separate duty under Reg SP to adopt written policies to protect data during disposal. This means shredding paper files, burning them, or properly wiping and destroying hard drives before tossing old computers. Dumpster diving is a real threat.
Phew. Okay. That is a staggering amount of regulatory plumbing. If you made it this far, your brain is probably full. Let's do a rapid fire recap of the top testable takeaways to lock this in before you go take a practice test. I'll start.
Go for it.
Number 1, the NDA protects commercial information. It does absolutely nothing to open an account. And Regulation FD only applies if the issuer is a reporting public company, like a PIPE. It does not apply to a startup.
Number 2, CIP requires 4 items. name, DOB address, ID number before the account opens. Verification of these items happens within a reasonable time after. The retention split is key. Identifying info is kept for 5 years after the account closes, but verification records are kept for 5 years after the record is physically made.
Number three, match the authorization doc to the entity. Power attorney for an individual, trust instrument for a trust, corporate resolution for a corporation. Do not let the exam swap a POA onto a corporation.
Number four, full discretion requires 3 written approvals, the customer, the firm's acceptance, and principal approval of each trade.
Yeah.
Limited discretion just covers time and price, and it turns into a pumpkin at the end of the day, unless extended in writing.
Number five, silence is not consent for electronic delivery, but silence is consent to share data under Reg SP because it defaults to opt out. Don't mix those two up.
Number six, subscription agreements need the issuer's countersignature to finalize the deal. And QIB letters need an executive officer's signature, like the CFO stating specific dollar amounts as of a specific date.
And lastly, number seven, Reg SP breach notifications must go out within 30 days of the firm becoming aware of the unauthorized access, not 30 days from the incident day itself.
Excellent summary. Want to leave everyone with a final thought to ponder as you study.
Lay it on us.
Think about how Regulation SP defaults to opt out. In a world where data is increasingly becoming the most valuable commodity on the planet, this regulatory framework places the burden entirely on the investor to build their own privacy walls.
It's crazy to think about.
As financial technology integrates deeper into every aspect of our lives, gathering more and more behavioral data, ask yourself, will this framework hold up? Or are we inevitably moving toward a future where opt-in becomes the only acceptable standard for data privacy?
A lingering question as we stare down the future of finance. All right, remember, if you can navigate the diagnostic muddy waters of this paperwork, you are going to absolute crush your Series 82 exam. Get out there, understand the why, and don't let the exam traps catch you slipping. Catch you next time.